Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I really enjoyed talking with Kevin Vost, but I really enjoyed his book, What is God? Answering the World's Most Important Question with Help from Thomas Aquinas. And what I should have said at the end of the last hour is if you're online, just stay online because Joe's here. And any question you had for Kevin Vost, you could ask for Joe. So maybe people stayed on the line. I don't know. But call back. We'll get you an answer. Joe Heschmeyer's here. Joe Heschmeyer is an extraordinary apologist. He is a shameless papist and a very fine author, including of the book The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe Heschmeyer, thanks for being here with us.
My pleasure.
You are a shameless papist, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, for those who don't get that joke, I started a blog called Shameless Popery. That was kind of my first foray into Catholic apologetics. So,
and you can talk to Joe.
I can't dodge the charge. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, being a shameless papist.
Yeah.
I don't think it's such a bad thing to be a papist. That's just another word for Catholic, right?
Yeah. The name of the blog was actually given to me from a Protestant friend of mine who meant it kind of ironically, and I thought it was funny, so I went with it from there.
The number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I wonder if anyone has ever collected all of the derogatory terms for a Catholic. You know, like kicks with the left foot and the mackerel snapper and all that kind of thing. I don't know.
This isn't directly on point from that, but it's similar. So I watched a PSA once years and years ago, and it was about anti-racism and like anti-ethnic stuff. And the way the ad was shot is it showed babies playing together of all different races and colors and all this. And on the right side of the screen were a list of ethnic slurs. And the point was that, like, they said no one is born racist. But a lot of them were not terms I had heard before. And I thought, I think this is not the intended effect.
Just giving you ideas.
That's where I learned the term mackerel snapper. And I thought, what does that mean? I was so curious about that one. I looked it up and thought, oh, it's me. It's a Catholic. And it seems to be we eat fish on Friday. And that's just not really an insulting insult at all. Like, it's just, okay, that's objectively true. Mackerel, not a bad fish even. I mean, if you said like...
Right.
You know, choose some horrible, like, oh, you eat a lot of whitefish. Okay, now it's maybe a little more insulting, but who knocks mackerel?
What's wrong with whitefish? Like, you know, like...
I was trying to think of a bad fish. Cod, maybe? I don't know. But I live in the middle of the country. I don't have fresh fish unless it's, like, trout.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. But you come up out here enough that you should know mahi-mahi or something like that. But it's weird that mackerel snapper is a derogatory term for Catholic... But snapper is also another name for a fish. So it could also just be a list of fish.
Snapper? Man.
A snapper snapper, yeah. 888-318-7884. Bonus points if you come up with a derogatory term. Not a vulgar one. You can't say something vulgar on the air. But if you share...
This is the worst on-air idea I've ever heard.
No, I want to hear some other... And I'm going to go to Facebook and see what the... Because you know the Facebook people right now are coming up with them. Like things that people call a Catholic. I didn't know that if you kicked with your left foot, you were a Catholic until I heard the guy on Downton Abbey say it. Like he was
what
like,
what does that mean though? Why?
I don't know because I guess if you kick, I don't know what it's some combination of soccer and you're playing soccer wrong. And so you're, I don't know, but I love Downton Abbey, first of all. And the guy, what's his name? The Earl, now I can't even remember.
Not the callers will remember. I've seen out.
I don't know why I'm drawing a blank on him, but he's got a very late 19th century anti-Catholicism, which is just dumb. Like he has no reason for it. He doesn't actually not like Catholics. He just says these anti-Catholic things because it's just what he grew up with. I think it's a great depiction. I don't know where I'm going. 888-318-7884 is the number. You can call any question you want, but if you give me a good anti-Catholic name, then I'll also give you a copy of my book, A Teacher of Strange Things, which is a book about Jesus. Daniel in Arizona, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. You are numero uno today, Daniel. Thanks for your call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, can you guys hear me pretty good?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
I'd say very good. I'd go with
all
very
right.
good.
Right up. So my question is, as a Catholic, I've seen a lot of information on Catholic.com, especially with Trent Horn and Joe yourself speaking on this, and it's the population argument against reincarnation. So my question is, how does the population argument work against reincarnation? We see the human population is obviously growing, but wouldn't the advocate of reincarnation just say there's proof of the animal population decreasing? They may mention, I don't know, bacteria, plants, etc. Just having a tough time understanding that portion of the population argument, kind of how to rebuttal that. So that's pretty much my question.
Yeah, it's a great question. Let me give a little background to your question for those who may not know what you're talking about. So the idea is that certain religions and belief systems endorse the idea of reincarnation. When you die, you come back as another person, or sometimes there's a crossover, as you kind of alluded to, between like animals and humans. You know, if you've been very good, you might come back as a human. If you've been bad, you might come back as an animal. And one of the obvious difficulties with this is that population doesn't stay the same. If you've got a set number of souls just being recycled through reincarnation, you should expect the human population to stay roughly the same, but it doesn't at all. You know, it's exploded compared to what it was even 100 years ago. And so where are these new souls coming from? Reincarnation doesn't really account for it. Now, Daniel is pointing out a possible counter to that, which is, well, couldn't you say they're coming from the animal world? That objection or that answer only works if you were able to argue that, you know, the overall number of living things has stayed roughly the same. And I don't think that's true at all. Certainly, if you look at the age of like the dinosaurs, when you've got like a global ice age or something like that, the overall population of living things seems to be much lower than it currently is as a whole. So I'm not a scientist. I can't tell you here's, you know, the trajectory of sentient beings, or here's the trajectory of organic life forms that we see on Earth. But I think it's safe to say that that number isn't stable. It's not static, which is what you would expect if reincarnation were true. Does that answer your question, Daniel?
Yeah, it pretty much does. I mean, I think I've seen it on somewhere on Catholic.com. I think Trent Horn mentioned it on one of his articles. He was stating that even at the Big Bang, you can always use that. You can maybe use that. I mean, that made me think maybe I can use that as a counterpoint to even that rebuttal by saying, well, at the Big Bang, if there was only, you know, there was nothing out there as far as we know, so then at that point, it'd have to be kind of at the same amount of souls. But if there's nothing in the beginning, you're kind of at a dead end as far as that rebuttal
goes
on from their point.
So let me clarify that in case anyone doesn't get what you mean there. That at some point, there was a time, whether it's Big Bang or however you understand early universal existence, that there's some point where living things didn't exist in the universe. And so everything has to have had some sort of incarnation. It had to come into existence. And it's difficult to see how reincarnation accounts for that at all. Like, you have to have, again, some number of souls. Where are they coming from? Why don't we see them a billion years ago or whatever? That kind of idea that if you grant that there is a time when living things didn't roam the universe, then you have to account for how they came into being. And reincarnation doesn't get you even one step closer, because it takes a living being with a soul and then claims to have a theory about what happens when it dies. It doesn't explain how you get the living beings with souls in the first place.
All right. I guess we're all set.
Yep,
okay. All right. Thank you very much for the call and for the question. It's open forum. All the lines are full right now. So we're going to go to the first break, and we'll be back with lots and lots of questions for our guest, Joe Heschmeyer. It was kick with the wrong foot. Someone just explained to me that I said kick with the left foot. A Catholic is someone who kicks with the wrong foot.
It sounds like you've got an anti-sinister bias.
Because left is sinister.
Sinister, yeah. You equate left foot with wrong foot. Interesting.
Yeah, but someone on Facebook said that in the UK, a Tim is a Catholic. Like, if you're called a Tim, then you're a Catholic. These are like the UK needs to come up with better slurs. These are the mildest slurs.
They've had so long.
They called
to
me
do
a
this.
Tim. I don't know what that has to do with. We'll be right back with more Open Forum. Joe Heschmeyer, Catholic Answers Live.
Tim. There's only one Catholic Answers Live. Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit MysticMonkCoffee.com. That's MysticMonkCoffee.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, "Why don't you air these people?" And I said, "No, because I don't think they're Catholic." He says, "By what right do you have to say that?" I said, "I own the network."
Mother Angelica Live Classics, tomorrow night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Television and Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. We're going to get to so many calls with the great Joe Heschmeyer this hour. And you know why I call him great. I say it cynically and ironically. 888-318-7884 is the number. I have been corrected yet again. Okay, so if you kick with the wrong foot, that means you're the wrong religion. But in Great Britain, among the aristocracy, a left footer is a Catholic. If you're a left footer, you're a Catholic. So I apologize to all the people in all of the British Isles, or including the Hebrides, and any Iceland. We'll go as far. Anyone in the Atlantic Rim, I apologize. I don't know your slang, but if you give me an anti-Catholic slur that's not vulgar,
I want to point out you are apologizing for not being able to correctly insult Catholics in regional slang.
I know
on a Catholic show, no less.
I'm sorry. I just am not good with my anti-Catholic slang. Josh in Memphis, Tennessee, watching on YouTube. You are El Nexto, which is actually not a word, but go ahead, Josh, with your question.
Hey, can you all hear me?
Very, very well. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, first of all, I just want to thank you all because my wife and I are in RCIA, and Catholic Answers is a really big part of that. So, thank you for everything you do here, Josh. Yeah, so my question, long story how this popped in my head, so I'll skip that as much as I want to, but so I know the church teaches like baptism of desire, right? So for someone who is honestly seeking baptism, they're driving to the church, they get hit by a bus, the church considers that baptism of desire, right?
Yep.
Or generally, yeah.
Yes, that's right.
So my
right.
question
yeah.
is, does that apply in the reverse to something like mortal sin? So like if someone like resolved firmly in their will to go and like say cheat on a spouse or something like that, mm-hmm. and they were in en route to go and do that. Mm-hmm. What is there any like official thought? Has anyone talked about that? Or I'm curious what their response is to something like that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And yes, someone has talked about it in Matthew 5, verse 27 and 28. Jesus said, "You've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." And the idea there is very simply, like, we want to distinguish between two types of desire. One is you have a natural attraction to sin. You have a temptation, that sort of thing. That's not actually a sin itself. Being tempted is not a sin. And that's a really important point to stress, because sometimes people will feel a lot of temptation, feel like they've committed a bunch of sins, when really they've just struggled with a lot of temptations. Maybe they've been heroically virtuous in the face of those temptations. But on the other hand, there are things that you consent to in the will, where you indulge a thought, you maybe make a plot, and maybe it doesn't work out. You know, you try to cheat on your wife and the woman says no. You don't get any points for, you know, someone else stopping your plan, or, you know, you attempt murder or something like those things are still mortally sinful. Now, we would say there's actually an increased gravity if your sin is successful. I mean, if you do murder someone, if you do commit adultery, you cause more damage. But nevertheless, consenting to a mortal sin, you've already agreed in the will to break off union with God in favor of sin.
Okay, so it really is that action of the will that's the primary component, even more so than the commission itself.
Yeah. So again, the commission can matter for the gravity and certainly for the effects of it. You might do more spiritual damage if you, you know, you try to do something wicked and you succeed. It might cause you more pain. It might make it harder in terms of the aftermath. But in terms of the sin itself, that the mere act of consenting to a mortal sin is a mortal sin, whether you successfully achieve it or not. And it is because of this principle that you kind of alluded to. Sin is in the will, we say. That something that's out of your control, you know, you have a dream or something you've got no control over, or a thought crosses your mind without willing it. Those kind of things aren't sinful by themselves. It's what do you do with those things, and what you do in terms of thinking about them as well as executing them. All of that's in the will, and that's where sin resides. Does that help? Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it does. It wasn't anything I was like struggling with or anything. It was just, it's one of those questions that popped in my head and figured this might be a good place to ask. So,
that's great. I'm glad you did.
Well, thanks, Josh. And what is the plan to come into full communion at Easter?
Yeah, exactly. My wife's already baptized, but I'm not. So that's the plan. So we're excited.
Praise God. That's wonderful. I love that you're in the process. I love you're taking it seriously. Love you're grappling with the big questions. And please, I think I speak on behalf of everybody. Call back anytime. These are some of the best calls.
Yeah.
Thanks, Josh.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska, where Sam is listening. What were you going to say? Spirit Catholic Radio?
Spirit Catholic Radio. Yeah.
Because if you're listening in Nebraska, you're probably listening on Spirit Catholic Radio.
Yeah.
Sam in Omaha, Nebraska, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Well, we're happy to, Sam.
Yeah.
Okay. So if the Pope is infallible, that's right?
Yes.
Yep.
So that means if he preaches anything concerning the faith or morals, he is always correct, right?
Not quite. If he defines something in terms of faith and morals, which is a little different. But if you want to spell out your question, I can kind of answer it all at once if that's easier.
Okay. So what if he preaches something that's blatantly immoral? Are we obliged to follow it?
No, and that's a really good question. So when we talk about infallibility, what we mean is this. When a theological controversy comes up in the church, that this can be handled by the visible church. So think about it, like in the early church in Acts 15, there was this thing called the Judaizer mm-hmm. controversy, where people said you have to live by the Mosaic law. And so these two groups of Christians disagreed. And what did they do? Well, they took it to the visible church, and the apostles and elders met together at council, and they came up with the right answer. And they said, it seems good to the Holy Spirit and to us. They answered on behalf of God what the right answer was on an issue where reasonable Christians might have disagreed prior to that. That's an authority that God gives the church, and that authority is exercised either by a council meeting together like that, or the Pope acting in his official capacity, settling a question of faith or morals. So what that doesn't mean is that anything the Pope says about faith and morals is automatically true or infallible or binding on Christians. What it does mean is that in these particular contexts where there's a declaration made by the church to say, this is what you have to believe, that we can know that's true. And one of the ways that we know that God is going to protect the church there is because if the Pope said, from now on, everyone has to believe a heretical thing, we would have to choose between one of two options. Either we'd have to go along with it, which would be heresy, or we'd have to break away from the church, which would be schism. And both heresy and schism are condemned in the Bible. There's no, you can commit heresy under these conditions ever given. There's no, you can commit schism under these conditions ever given. And so if heresy and schism are never to be done, well, the only way we can be saved from being put into that impossible position is if God supernaturally prevents the visible church and the Pope from ever imposing heresy upon us. Does that distinction make sense? So the point of infallibility is not to protect the Pope. It's not to say that everything the Pope says and does is automatically right. The point of infallibility is, if you will, to protect us from the Pope, that the Pope will never be able to force something immoral upon Christians as a condition for membership in the church upon pain of heresy.
Mm.
Does that make
sense? Does that make sense, Sam? Okay.
That does make sense.
Well, let me ask you this. We got a book about the Pope called Pope Peter by our seventh best apologist. So if you would like a copy of that, just hang on the line.
He means me, Sam. He means me. Oh. He's a bad person.
Oh, okay.
also by Joe. All right, Sam, hang on, and we'll send you a copy of Pope Peter. And call back anytime you got a question. But the lines continue full, so on we go. Christopher, right here in Salinas, California, watching on YouTube. Christopher, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good, how are you?
Good. So my question is regarding St. Joseph's intercession. I've been doing a little bit of research on St. Joseph. I know that I've also found some prayers that St. Joseph is a good intercessor for finding a job when needed. I'm just going to share a little testimonial. In August, I was in Mexico. I got a little statue of St. Joseph at the Basilica Guadalupe. When I came back to the U.S. At my job place, they told me they weren't going to need me anymore, so I resigned and so went to a career fair, finding jobs. About 2 weeks ago, I applied for some new jobs, and one of them, I got the job, and tomorrow's going to be my first day at my new job. And
well, congratulations.
During that time, I was finding a new job. During that time, I was asking St. Joseph to help me find a new job.
Wonderful. Yeah, so to answer your question, Christopher, yes, absolutely. So one of the titles for St. Joseph is he's described as the guardian or the protector of the church. And the idea is like this. Once in the very beginning, the visible church consisted only of Jesus and the womb of his mother Mary. So there were two Christians, Jesus, if you want to call him that, and Mary. You had the head and body. And Joseph was then given the role of protecting the entire church, Mary and Jesus. And he does this in the flight into Egypt, and we see this role. So he's the protector of the whole church, that he has been from the very beginning, before even the first Christmas. And so as the church has grown, as more people have joined the family of God in this way, Joseph is still, we entrust him with the special requests, not to replace God, of course, but just recognizing that he's been given this pride of place to spiritually intercede and to look out for these spiritual children. So anything where there's a major issue, and including certainly finding a job, it's good to get in the habit of asking Joseph's intercession. I have found him personally to be a tremendous intercessor. I mean, to share my own testimonial, I was asked to join the Catholic Answers team on St. Joseph's Day, and it's my name day, and I've found numerous times in my life that it's been a big day. When I was very young, I was in the hospital, and it looked like I might die, and I came out of the hospital on St. Joseph's Day. Like, he really does. He looks out for us, and we should make a habit of going to him with major prayer requests.
Okay, Christopher?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Wonderful.
All right.
Okay, great.
Well, God bless you, and thank you very, very much for that. I'm going to keep moving. Joe, you're very popular. Every line full. Brent in Ontario, Canada, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Brent, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Where I'm from, the derogatory term was growing up was Dogon.
Oh!
I don't know if that's...
A Dogon is a Catholic,
we
yeah.
Dogon.
Yeah.
I've never even heard that.
Can I just say something? I appreciate you sharing that, but my experience now for the last half hour of looking these up and hearing them is the people who come up with slang terms for Catholic aren't very good at coming up with slang terms. There's no good slang terms for Catholic. But
also, I want to highlight to everyone that if Cy has seemed particularly distracted, it's because he's looking up curse words on the internet.
No, they're not curse words. They're just They're just
religious slurs on the internet.
Yes, that's not curse words. That's a different thing. All right, Brent, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, so I understand David ate the showbread out of necessity, but I was curious as to why he would wear the priestly garment without being of the tribe of Levi. I don't know how to pronounce it. Ephod, I think.
Yes, this is mysterious. So when David is dancing before the Lord, we see him stripped down to these kind of like priestly vestments. And it is very curious as to why he does this. And one answer to that is that in the Old Testament, there are all of these figures who foreshadow Jesus. And Jesus is the Christ, and Christ means anointed. And there's three groups of people in the Old Testament who are anointed: priest, prophet, and king. And so we talk about these three aspects of Christ's mission and identity, that he's priest, prophet, and king. And so if you look through the Old Testament, you see all sorts of figures who capture one or sometimes two of those. You never get anyone who's all three, who's priest, prophet, and king. The closest you get is King David, who seems to do some priestly things. And it's not clear why he does them. It's not clear if he should do them. But there are these times where he's doing them. Sometimes clearly inappropriately, like trying to move the ark into Jerusalem. Other times it's mysterious, but it seems to point forward to Jesus.
Brent, thanks. And thanks for sharing a Catholic slang word. But that's the hard music. Got to take this break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer. The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What humorous or inspiring church signs have you seen?
We want to hear about them Monday on Take 2 with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to more of Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. The number is 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and it's open forum. And I'll tell you how popular Joe is. There's one line open right now. Every other line has somebody online wanting to talk with Joe. Joe is an apologist here at Catholic Answers. He's the founder of Shameless Popery, and he's the author of a whole lot of books, including A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Time. Did you mention that when you were talking about all that stuff, your relationship with Saint Joseph? Did you even mention that you wrote a book about him?
I did not. I'm not good at the self-promotion thing. I am not not great in that area.
You're not one of those.
You know, I guess anyone who's a Knight of Columbus, their magazine, I just wrote an article for them on Saint Joseph and why he was considering divorcing Mary.
And what do they pay over there at the Catholic?
I don't want to make Todd feel jealous or anything.
What kind of money you get for it? Because I'd be willing to write something for the Knights of Columbus. Not that they'd have me. Steve in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, listening on 94.3 FM. You are next up. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yeah, hi, guys. Thank you for taking my call. I really enjoy the show. Thank you.
Well, thank you. How have you enjoyed the Catholic slang?
You can ignore that.
It's been great.
Well, you're very generous. Thank you.
There was a question a couple weeks ago. I believe it was with Carlo Broussard, and the question was whether or not the true presence of Christ was present in the Eucharist in the Orthodox Church. And his answer was that it was, because they have a valid priesthood. But and if I understood correctly, the difference between the Orthodox and the Catholic Church is that the Orthodox question the authority of the Pope. And so my question is, how can the Orthodox have a valid priesthood if there's a question about the authority of the Pope? Because wouldn't that put into question the apostolic, I don't think I'm saying the right word, apostolic succession, whatever.
That's a great question.
That's where my question is.
Yeah, that's a great question, Steve. So, first, I want to second what Carlo apparently said. The Orthodox do have valid sacraments. An important point here is that every bishop is a successor of the apostles. And Vatican II actually makes this point, and the Catechism makes this point, that bishops are not to be regarded as vicars of the Pope. In other words, the bishop in your diocese is not just middle management for the Pope. If you're in Springfield, Cape, you've got Bishop Rice, right? He's great. But he's not just a vicar of Pope Francis. He is a successor of the apostles in his own right. And so the Orthodox have valid apostolic succession. They can trace their bishops back to the apostles just like we can. The problem is that they don't accept the unity that the Pope provides. So the Eastern Church Fathers, as well as the Western ones, recognize this role that the Pope played. One of the Church Fathers, I believe it was St. John Chrysostom, referred to the Pope as Corypheus, which in like ancient Greek theater, you would have like singing and dancing, and you'd have basically a band leader who would set the tune and keep everyone dancing in rhythm. And that was the image that he used for the role of the Pope. He keeps everybody dancing in time to the same rhythm, singing the same tune. It's a really beautiful understanding of kind of the role of the papacy. And that's been lost since then with the Great Schism. But the Orthodox would still tell you that the Pope has some kind of primacy, but they reject his authority. They think he overdoes it. But there is still a recognition that the Catholic Church can be traced back to the apostles just as much as the East can be. The difference really is, how do we respect or not respect the authority of the Pope in that regard? But it does not mean that they don't have valid sacraments, because as long as they have a valid priesthood and they've got valid bishops, then they have valid Eucharists. Does that help, Steve?
Yep, that helps. Thank you.
All right.
Great.
Thank you very, very much. The number is 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer here. It's open forum this afternoon, and we're going to San Antonio, Texas, where Katie is watching on YouTube. Hi, Katie. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi. Thank you guys so much for taking my call.
Happy to.
Yeah.
My question is, if you have a preferred priest, but their like confession times that they do for their parish isn't for like another few days, should you wait to go see your preferred priest, or go see a priest as soon as possible if you know that you've sinned? Because I have a couple friends who, like, they claim like they go to one priest, and then it seems like they don't really listen because they don't ask a lot of questions, and they have one priest that'll kind of sit there and talk with them.
I see. Katie, good question. It depends a little bit on the gravity of the sin. I mean, if you're just dealing with something like venial sin, by all means, just go to your normal priest at the appropriate time. But if you're in a state of kind of a spiritual crisis, if you've fallen into mortal sin, and particularly if you've fallen into mortal sin in such a way that it's hard to get back up, you know what I mean by that? Like, sometimes it happens that you commit a mortal sin and you think, well, I've already fallen, I'm just going to stay down. And you sort of lose the energy for the fight a little bit. You just sort of give in. If you find yourself, or if your friends find themselves in that spot, get to confession as soon as humanly possible, and don't worry about whether it's your preferred priest or not. That would be my recommendation there. But then also, in addition to that, make an act of contrition even before you go. Like, if it happens for whatever reason, you can't get to confession right away, make an act of contrition with as much sincerity of heart as you possibly can. And just lay your soul bare before God, and then, you know, trust that God in his mercy is not going to have you get hit by a bus 5 minutes before you make it to confession or something. That he'll take care of you there, as long as you're serious about repentance and confessing.
Okay, Katie? Do we lose Katie? Well, I'm gonna go with... Oh, sorry. Yeah. Katie, that all makes sense?
No, I said thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, okay. I guess we
thought you were like struck dumb by how
brilliant that answer was. Thanks, Katie. That's the second time. This is the second question that involved getting hit by a bus today. Like twice we've mentioned getting hit by a bus. Don't do it again, Joe. No more getting hit by a bus.
Well, you don't want it to happen. That's all I'm saying.
Romanist.
Yeah.
That's one. Romanist.
That's a good one. It's just like, cheesy. Oh, yeah, you guys like Rome.
Yeah, like
our own Carrie Beck is texting me ones as well. He says Sponger or Spong.
Sponger is a Catholic? Yeah. Oh.
Apparently so.
I have to look that one up.
He said he has an Irish cop guide to offensive language. I don't know. Only Carrie Beck would have
an
this.
Irish what guide?
It's PSNI, so it's the Northern Irish Police.
Oh.
The former Ulster Royal Brigade has apparently a guide to language not to use, and he is looking through that to find all the Catholic stuff not to use.
So if you see someone in a Roman collar, don't say Sponger to him. Okay.
Because he'll be confused. Yeah.
Like, no, they probably know over there. It's like slurs over here. Like it's just nobody's...
Speaking of which, real quick.
Yeah.
I was in Dublin. I was in the north of Dublin. And the family I was staying with said, oh, you got to go into the city center. The crack is 90. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but it sounds like you're offering me drugs.
I know.
But it turns out the crack is 90 just means it's a lot of fun.
That's the best thing about the Irish is that they use the word crack completely differently than we do.
And they spell it completely
That's the very
incorrectly.
Best. Better than everything else about Ireland. Well, all right. I'm exaggerating on that one. Jacqueline in Irving, Texas. Katie, thank you very much for that call. Jacqueline in Irving, Texas is next. Listening on the EWTN app. Jacqueline, thank you for your patience. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, sure.
So I need help. My brother keeps sending on our group chat this image of it's like the bread and wine in a cereal bowl, and it says communion toast crunch, and it says for when you're like, you know, for your sins. And I keep telling him, like, you know, that's very inappropriate. And what his response was, well, my God has humor. I don't know about yours. And so last time he sent it, he actually got shingles, which I told him, like,
oh, man, I'm in trouble if that's what...
Remember the last time you got shingles. And so he thinks it's funny.
Well,
I don't think it's funny at all.
I don't know. Go ahead, Joe.
So what's his religious background? Where is he at religiously?
So we are Catholic, of course.
Oh, okay. So he is too.
He is a part of the Knights of Columbus, and he's got like a, I don't know. So he is a practicing Catholic, but I think he's just trying to be funny and, you know, send it after a fun weekend. But I don't think it's funny. Yeah.
I completely agree with you. It's not appropriate, and this idea like, oh, well, you know, God's got a sense of humor and all of that. It's a really cheap way of justifying behavior that's just irreverent. Like, God, exactly. If you understood even an iota about who God is, the last thing you would want to do is treat him that disdainfully and disrespectfully. One thing you could do, I don't know if he would kind of listen to it, but the Catechism in paragraph 2148 has a section on blasphemy. And it includes, you know, failing to respect God in one's speech. And St. James condemns those who blaspheme the honorable name by which you are called. So anytime you're using the name of the Lord or even religious things in these sort of sacrilegious ways, that's something you got to be really kind of mindful of. And while we're on the subject of sacrilege, that's also condemned. And so paragraph 2120 of the Catechism talks about profaning or treating unworthily the sacraments and other liturgical actions, such as persons, things, or places consecrated to God. And so certainly that meme fits that description very squarely. And so the idea isn't, does God have a sense of humor? The idea is sacrilege funny to God? And it seems like if you understand anything about Catholicism, the answer to that is no. And if you read the Old and New Testament, the answer to that is pretty clearly no. he doesn't treat lightly the sin of sacrilege. So I think just continue to be really forceful on that. And I think it's okay to even put up appropriate boundaries. If he won't listen to you, just say, look, I'm going to kick you off the group thread, or I'm going to leave the group thread if you keep doing this, because this is totally disrespectful, not only to God, but also to me, who's asked you several times to stop this offensive and insulting behavior. You would never expect that in reverse. So I don't know if that helps at all, Jacqueline, but that's where I would maybe start with that. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Jacqueline. I appreciate that. I got to take the break. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. I looked up that book of slang things that the Northern Irish police are not supposed to say. And it's got a whole thing where it says don't say and then do say. And Spunger is on there for a Catholic. And I, as an American, we don't.
Is that
know.
A don't say or a do say?
No, don't say Spunger. You're not supposed to say that. My favorite of all of them, though, is if you meet an elderly man, don't say old codger.
I disagree. Look, I'm going to give a blanket pass.
Yeah, say old codger. Old come enough. On.
And once I'm like Carrie Beck's age, you can call me old codger all you want.
Don't say so. Carrie Beck. Carrie Beck is young and in the prime of his life.
Don't say
old codger. Yes. What? Don't say old codger. All right, we'll be.
I only say that because I know Carrie's listening because he's texting me. So.
But Carrie, he's not going to forgive this. There's no way. You're not going to ever sell another book because Carrie's never going to book you.
That's true.
You've sold your last book, Joe Heschmeyer. Right back with more open
forum. He's no longer at my beck and call.
On Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The EWTN On Demand platform features 50 new podcasts every week, as well as an ever-expanding library of audio and video content. For Catholics who want to learn more about their faith, simply using their mobile device, computer, or TV. Your favorite EWTN programs are available 24/7. Visit EWTN.com and click On Demand. EWTN, the global Catholic network.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. It's open forum. You can call and ask whatever you like. And we're going to go next to Rebecca in Morrisville, North Carolina, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Rebecca, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about a trip that my dad, who is a Protestant missionary, just went on. I'm Catholic, and he went to Iraq and went to the church that, from what I can tell looking at history, split from the Catholic Church in the 8th century, and they claim to be the original church, and they say that the Catholic Church is the first Protestant church because it actually split from them, mm-hmm. And they can trace their lineage back to the Apostle to St. Thomas. So I don't quite know how to answer him on that. He's pretty anti-Catholic, and now he's really excited that he feels like he's found the original church, and well, I'm not quite sure what to tell him about that.
We found some slang terms you could share with him if he's a real anti-Catholic.
Okay. You can ignore my fellow Catholic answers person here. No, that's a great question. So the first thing I'd say is kind of challenge him on that. Say, okay, if you're convinced this is the first church, go become a Syrian. Like, follow, like, if you really believe everyone should be part of this church you found in Iraq, go join it. Like, if that's what you think God is calling us to. But, so that'd be one way. It would actually be better than for him to be Protestant, in the sense that they actually have a valid priesthood. It is, I don't know if you heard the earlier conversation, but the Orthodox have valid sacraments. This is also true of these, what are called Oriental Catholic churches. So it sounds like he's talking about the Assyrian Church of the East. He may be talking about one of like the Martoma Syro-Malachabar churches or something like that. I don't know exactly which one he means. But yeah, there are churches in Iraq and other parts of that region that really can trace their lineage back like 2,000 years and pretty credibly say the Apostle Thomas came through here on his way to India and he set up a Christian community, he set up a church, and it survived. And some of them went off the rails with things like Nestorianism. And they became heretical, but they didn't sacrifice the whole idea of the priesthood. I think it's worth challenging him and saying, isn't it fascinating that they have all of these things that you would totally reject in the Catholic Church? Isn't it fascinating they have bishops and priests, they've got divine liturgy, they've got a Eucharistic sacrifice, they've got all these things that allegedly are like these medieval inventions, and here's this church that can credibly claim to be founded by an apostle that has all of these as well. The kicker, though, is that it's not the only church founded by the apostles. That rather, of all the different local churches founded by the apostles, St. Peter in Rome, this is the one considered to have a special authority. This is considered not just later on, very, very early on. For instance, St. Irenaeus, when he's talking about this in Against Heresies, Book 3, says that it's a matter of necessity that all churches agree with this church. That's in 180 AD. That this church, of all the different apostolic churches, this one is viewed as the kind of center of unity and of orthodoxy. And so churches that break away from that, the Nestorian churches and the like, we view them as having gone astray, not of breaking off. To say that like we all broke off from the church in Iraq is like cutting off your hand and saying that you cut off your body, that your body left your hand. Like obviously that's, you know, if you know where the center is, then you realize that's a very strange way to describe that schism. I don't know if that helps, but those would be the two things I would say. Number one, look at all these things we have in common that Protestants don't have anymore. And number two, if we have to sort out all of the churches that can be traced to the apostles, which one to trust, the early Christians actually give us a means by which to do that.
What do you think, Rebecca?
Cool. That's good. That's good. I feel like it just reconfirms for him how wonderful it is to have all these different branches that don't claim to be the one that, you know, all roads lead to. And I think it just kind of further confirmed that to him, that there was another church, you know, that claims to be able to trace it back that far.
So they wouldn't say just choose whatever apostolic church. They wouldn't say just choose any church that can be traced back 2,000 years. Neither would the Orthodox. So this kind of almost moral relativism that you see in Protestantism about denominations, about churches, that is not – none of the ancient churches take that position. That's a very modern kind of Enlightenment view that is totally apart from anything in Christianity. You don't see the people in Acts saying, well – just be a part of whatever church you want to be a part of. It doesn't matter if you follow the apostles or the super apostles over here. No, it actually matters what visible church you're part of. And they're very clear about that.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Thank you so much. That's a great point.
Yeah, you bet, Rebecca.
Thanks, Rebecca. Thank you very much. I'm going to go to Nashville now. Tom in Nashville, Tennessee, listening on the EWTN app. Go ahead with your question for Joe, Tom.
Hey, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. Joe, I need to get some information about the early church. I got a New York Times bestseller on my nightstand by an author named Cy Kellett, who wrote A Teacher of Strange Things. And I was reading about Jesus, and I was like, man, I've got to learn more about the early church. And I know Joe Heschmeyer is the man who knows it. So I wanted to ask you, sir, about Eucharistic adoration and when, as a church, we started doing that practice, like how early that was. Mm-hmm. I did hear the Last Supper's when the first time Jesus kind of made that, but I want to know more about that, if you could tell me more, sir.
So when you say Eucharistic adoration, do you mean the Eucharist just being adored in the Mass, or do you mean reserving the Eucharist outside of Mass? Do you get that distinction? Because there's two stages. Yeah. Every Mass, we have the body and blood, soul and divinity of Jesus Christ, and we approach that with worship, with reverence. And this is very clear from reading the biblical evidence and very clear from reading the earliest Christian authors like Ignatius of Antioch. He's writing in 107. In his letter to the Smyrnians, he's explicit that the Eucharist is the flesh and blood of Jesus Christ. And so we find that all the way back. In 1 Corinthians 10 and 11, St. Paul compares receiving Jesus in the Eucharist to the way that pagans become united with demons and pagan sacrifices, and the way the Jews would become united with the animal sacrifices. And so he's very clear this is a sacrifice. And it's a sacrifice of what? It's a sacrifice of God, that we're uniting ourselves to the sacrifice in Calvary. So that's all right there in Scripture. And all of that is kind of spelled out. Now, I have a book called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, in which I have a chapter that deals with that. So we'll send you a copy of that if you stay on the line. I'm also finishing up a book right now that's entirely devoted to the Eucharist. So if you want to maybe keep an eye and ear out, I don't know when that's going to come out because I'm a little behind schedule, but it won't be too long. There'll be a book on the Eucharist that I've written that'll address those things as well. But for now, let me send you a copy of Early Church Was a Catholic Church, and hopefully that'll kind of help explore some of that history.
Okay, Tom?
Hey, thank you. That sounds great. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, Tom, thank you. Thank you for mentioning my book. And if it is, in fact, a New York Times bestseller, somebody owes me a lot of money because I didn't see a check like that for it. So I will be looking into this, Tom. I'm going to go to Julio now. But hang on, get your book, Tom. Julio in Merced, California, watching on YouTube. Julio, wait, I got to put Tom on hold so we don't lose him. Okay, go ahead, Julio, with your question.
Julio? Hello, I just wanted to, yes.
Go ahead, yeah.
I just wanted to see what Joe's thoughts were on, the scandals that there have been with priests or cardinals being sexually immoral. And with in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where it mm-hmm. says that sexually immoral people should be expelled from among us mm-hmm. or among the church. I guess I want to know how to reconcile that with,
But with what actually happened?
They can be forgiven, but
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Joe?
Let me give a two-part answer to that. First, a lot of people didn't do their jobs. A lot of bishops didn't actually shepherd the sheep or keep them from the wolves. Fair number of bishops were wolves. That's the first and probably clearest thing that needs to be said here. But second, we do want to make a distinction. 1 Corinthians 5, you're dealing with an unrepentant, sexually immoral person. There's a follow-up to that. There's sort of a sequel. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 5 to 10, or 5 to 11. Paul says, okay, ease up on him, forgive him, bring him back in. And so you should be, you are cut off from the Eucharistic life of the church if you're in a state of mortal sin. We still do that. Not everyone lives by it, but that's at least on paper how things ought to go, and it often is the way things go. But we also leave place for repentance and forgiveness. So the person who repents of sexual sin or any sin, we happily welcome them back in. So that's the distinction. No matter what sin you've committed, the person writing 1 Corinthians 5 is a former murderer. It's someone who killed Christians and then was repentant. So any sin, no matter how serious, can be forgiven. But the unrepentant mortal sinner cuts themselves off from the life of the church.
Julio, what do you make of that?
That sounds okay. I guess I just wonder if people like that should be left in their positions if they have a high position in the church.
Right, right.
I'll offer my own suggestion that no, they should not. And, I'm grateful that Cardinal McCarrick is no longer Cardinal McCarrick. He's now just Mr. McCarrick. That the church did eventually take decisive action there. That happens probably more rarely than it should, for a lot of reasons. Some of them good, like we want to err on the side of mercy. But some of them bad, like just an inability to enforce church teaching and doctrine. It seems like these situations improving a little. But yeah, so I think I agree with you that we could do more in this area.
Thanks, Julio. Thanks, everybody. Joe, thank you very much for an hour of open forum. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow we're going to do 2 more hours of open forum. So if we didn't get to your question today or you weren't able to call, but you'd like to call tomorrow, please do. Open forum. You are very welcome. Joe, I said to anybody who called and gave me a slang word for a Catholic, I would give him a book. And then a guy called up and he said Dogen. And I never gave him a book. I never gave him anything. Call back tomorrow if I owe you a book.
You can send him a teacher of strange things, or if you really get on his bad side, send him 2 copies.
That's mean. See you tomorrow.